and welcome to the Provider Podcast. I am Susan Ball. In this week's episode, we'll be focusing on health inequalities. Health inequalities have always been a concern, but the need to tackle unjust and avoidable differences in people's health has understandably shot up the agenda in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. The pandemic laid bare the terrible toll of long-standing inequalities in health outcomes between different groups, including those from more deprived backgrounds, from ethnic minorities, and for those with severe mental illness or learning disabilities. NHS trusts have a key role to play in tackling these health inequalities, but progress to reduce disparities has been worryingly slow in some areas. While the will to act might be there, NHS leaders may struggle to know where to start given the complexity of this issue and how it varies from one local area to the next. To help overcome these barriers, NHS providers has created a practical guide for NHS Trust Board members. The guide aims to help them as they steer their organisations on their journey towards reducing health inequalities and embedding this as core business across their organisation. Let's speak to Rachel McEwen, NHS Providers Policy Advisor for Health Inequalities, Christine Camacho, Public Health Registrar at Northern Care Alliance NHS Foundation Trust, who created the original guide for NHS boards, and Dominique Allwood, Director of Population Health at Imperial College Healthcare NHS Trust. So Christine, let's start with you. What are health inequalities?
Health inequalities are unjust and avoidable differences in health outcomes across the population and between specific groups. So, for example, homeless people in this country have an average age of death of just 47 years old. Black women are four times more likely to die after childbirth than white women. And in the most deprived areas, England, we are seeing bigger hospital waiting lists and longer waiting times. Most of those inequalities in health are driven by factors such as poverty, access to decent housing, educational opportunities, and good quality employment, referred to as the wider determinants of health. But about 20% of health inequalities are driven by differences in access, experience, and outcomes across our health services.
So, Christine, there's some really stark figures that you just shared there. And I mean, it'd be really helpful to know what's the scale of the problem and why should trust leaders be so concerned about the extent of health inequalities and disparities in the country?
So we can see the impact of health inequalities across every aspect of NHS service delivery. For example, how able are people to attend an appointment? Are we sending that information out in the right language? Is the letter written in an accessible way? Are we thinking about transport arrangements and the time of day that we're offering those appointments? We see differences in patient satisfaction with hospital care, which may be experiences of racism or a lack of interpreters being provided. We also know that some people are more likely to use planned care like GP appointments, and some people are more likely to use emergency care like phoning for an ambulance. And a lot of that is driven by health inequalities.
And what are the reasons why trusts should take action on health inequalities?
So this is really about fairness, and that is enshrined in the NHS Constitution, that the NHS operates fairly and effectively. But it's not just a moral and social justice imperative, it's a legal duty. So under the Health and Care Act, NHS trusts must consider health inequalities. And our regulator, the Care Quality Commission, will also be asking trusts about what they are doing around health inequalities. And also tackling health inequalities can lead to productivity and efficiency benefits for trusts. So there's a myriad of reasons for trusts to be doing this important work.
Thank you, Christine. And then Rachel, so obviously NHS Providers has created this new guide for Trust Board members. My question to you is, why have we launched this guide and why are we doing it now?
So for me, it feels as though in the last few years, there's been a growing level of attention and focus on reducing health inequalities. And there's a growing body of evidence from people like Michael Marmot's Institute for Health Equity that shows inequalities are worsening over time. So for me, I think we can't afford to leave it another 10 years before we take action. It feels like we really need to take action and for trusts to identify their role and their part to play in reducing health inequalities. So as part of my role at NHS Providers, I've been in the process of reaching out to trusts to hear about the work that they're doing to reduce health inequalities. And one of the answers that I quite commonly hear is that there are many barriers preventing trusts from taking action. And one of those barriers is just not knowing where to start. And I think part of that is because health inequalities can seem like such a huge and complex problem. It can feel really overwhelming and it can be challenging to identify what the specific role for trusts is because it's really busy and, like I say, complex. And often when we think of those wider determinants of health that Christine was talking about, it can be hard to think about what the role of the health sector is within that. So I think for us, we're trying to identify what the role of the health service plays in improving access to services for patients, improving the experience of services, and improving patient outcomes and outcomes for communities as well. And I think over the past few years, there's been a wealth of policy advice and guidance from NHS England and others that's related to health inequalities. So we've seen things like Core 20 plus 5 framework for reducing health inequalities, the Statement on Information for Health Inequalities, the EDI Improvement Plan, and the list goes on and on. I think one of our aims in producing this guide was to bring together all of that relevant policy advice, all of that guidance, and combine that into a list of suggested objectives for trust board members to take. I think the important thing is that it provides a list of possible actions. For those trusts that think, I don't know where to start, I don't know what to do, this provides guidance for them.
And Rachel, when you were talking to trusts, did some of them give you examples of things that they're already doing? And so kind of that is one of the aims and hopes of this, that they will share and disseminate good practice that's already out on the ground.
Yes, yeah, so definitely from the trust that we speak to, we know that a lot of good work is already taking place. And part of our role at NHS Providers is to share that good practice as much as we can. I think with this guide, what we've done is provided a vision for what good looks like for trusts who want to act on health inequalities. So we've identified 4 key areas where we think trusts could prioritise their action in order to see improvements. So these areas are from having leadership around the topic of health inequalities, having a strategic focus and commitment to take action, boosting public health expertise within trusts, and enhancing data analysis and interpretation. So as I said, we've set out an aspirational view of what good looks like in each of these 4 areas, which is drawn from existing examples of good practice.
Now, Dominique, you're obviously based in a big London trust. What does health inequalities look like to you on the ground?
Thanks, Susan. It's a really good question. And when you think about what hospital provider organisations are there to do, often they'll have things in their strapline like Better Health for Life. My organisation certainly does. But if we think about the main activity that goes on in organisations like that, it is about treating people who are acutely unwell or have chronic diseases or illnesses or injuries. So thinking about that concept of health is really important. And then you start to unpack, well, what does that mean and who for? And we can look at the kind of the heat maps of our populations and see wide kind of gaps and disparities in things like life expectancy. But as you say, what does that mean for a hospital? I guess one of the first times I really had an engaging conversation with a group of clinicians was about their outpatient appointments. And we were talking about, it's really busy in outpatients and they're often really overbooked, trying to fit as many patients in as they can. And isn't it a relief when 2 or 3 people don't turn up because actually I'll get a few minutes back to catch up on my notes, or if I'm even luckier, I might get to leave the clinic early. But we started to unpick that and look at the data and see, well, who are the people that aren't coming? And what if you knew as a clinician leading that clinic that the people not coming may be twice as likely to be from a non-white background or from a deprived community? That starts to give you a different sense of oh, those people aren't showing up, but actually now I feel like I want to understand more, and why is it certain groups over others? And so that's in one way what health inequalities looks like. People who don't have the same access, not coming to our services, not being able to receive care, their outcomes might be worse, and their experience might be worse. For example, in our interpreting services, we know patients often really struggle with that. Staff struggle to get those services appropriately at the time that's needed. The patients sometimes struggle with the quality of that. That's having an impact on what they understand their care to be, their ability to follow instructions and compliance with treatment. So for people whose language, English is not their first language, or perhaps need, you know, British Sign Language, different types of interpreting, they're then falling behind in terms of their ability to receive and benefit from care. So you start to see at individual patient level, that adds up to big stark issues for organisations around what they're doing around access for particular patient groups, what they're doing around experience and outcomes, safety. And you can start to then cut the data by all of those metrics. So if you take any kind of metric of quality, let's just say it's a late night move of a patient, a late night transfer on a ward, that's a quality metric. We shouldn't really be moving patients late at night. But actually, if you were to cut that by data that looks at patients' language or ethnicity background, we'd often see in some organisations big gaps in the types of people who have that happen to them. So it's about, I guess, understanding where some of these issues lie and how to explore them. We've been doing lots to look at that, but making it real for individual clinicians to see that in their patients, but also for organisational leaders to think, gosh, we may have some systemic problems here that we need to tackle.
So Dominic, you highlighted some really interesting points there around issues around things like language, access to interpreting services, quality and access to care. And so once you've identified those, how has your trust gone about trying to kind of tackle those specific like health inequalities? Like, what measures have you put in place to actually address them?
Yeah, so I guess the first thing to go back to is just raising the awareness, making sure that people really understand the issues, the significance of them, and that there's an appreciation that as an organisation, we do and can have a role to play in tackling some of those. There's no point in looking at lots of data and polishing problems if we then can't do much about it. We as a trust used quality improvement tools to understand some of the root causes, to dispel some of the myths that, oh, most of this is out of our control. We actually had a look at the things we could control and change. And we've started a number of priority areas for the organisation and improvement projects. And so one of them is around tackling smoking cessation and tobacco dependency. It's a big national priority, but actually taking a health inequality lens, the people that are most likely to smoke are often in some of those core 20 plus 5 groups. The people that least get asked whether they smoke and least get offered the treatment sit in many of those groups as well. So you can see you start to perpetuate inequalities all the way down the line on that. So we're doing a big programme of work on health inequalities through the lens of risk factors such as smoking that contributes to other diseases and illnesses that have an inequality gradient as well. We're also looking at patients who don't attend their appointments, the DNAs that I've mentioned. Try to understand who doesn't come, but from a patient perspective, why is that and what can we do as an organisation? So we've worked with a brilliant organisation called the Helix Centre, who are helping us really understand and co-produce solutions. And as has already been alluded to, for example, changing the time that appointments happen. If you are a busy working parent that can't take time off school to bring your child, you're somebody that needs to take advantage of subsidised travel, an appointment and the first thing in the morning is just going to be something you can't come to. If we send a letter out in English saying call this number and press this button if you need it in a different language, patients who don't speak English aren't going to be able to access that. So there are some immediate and obvious changes organisations can make, but thinking about it from the perspective of patients and communities is really important. So we've done quite a bit of co-designing and understanding. We're also looking at our waiting lists, and we're also thinking about our patient experience. And I've mentioned some examples about translation services. So we picked those four priority areas to say we want to start tackling inequalities. We want to think about things that are in our control. And we're going to do those over the next 2 years. We've got a number of slower burn, longer term projects, because obviously when you start to tackle these issues, they're really like deep rooted. And the things that will make a difference to social determinants of health inequalities often lie outside of the hospital walls. So we're doing a partnership with our local authority under our anchor institution work programme to start to tackle some of the wider social determinants of health. But all of this work sits under a health equity framework, and having a sort of strategic approach in the organisation has been really helpful. So I think it's both about what in terms of the projects and programmes and approaches we can take and the how. And one of those things is about the strategy that pulls all of that together to make it more intentional, visible, resourced, etc.
So two really interesting points that you've raised there. So if I start with the first one, so you mentioned as like areas for change that you've already put in place, things around smoking and then did not attend. So like from the changes that you've already put in place, are you seeing differences in terms of how patients are now behaving because of the changes you've put in place, as a trust?
So we're really starting to put measurement at the forefront of what we're doing. And you can imagine in organisations that are drowning in data, actually it's quite hard to sift through and really understand, are we making a difference on inequalities? And having staff skilled to really know that is important. So I'll wind the story back a bit and say we're also putting effort and attention into both having data that is available that gives us the answers to those questions, and also people skilled to understand how to use that information. So if you look at things like our DNA appointments, you can create run charts or SPC charts to look at how that data is trending over time. And in several of our clinical specialties now, we've got dashboards available to look at that and cut it by different characteristics. If you take an overall graph in one of our areas, it looks like we've actually managed to really reduce that amount of appointments that people don't show up for. And that's great for patients, that's better for us as an organisation, less waste, etc. If you cut that by ethnic group, you can see that actually several of the non-white population groups are actually getting worse in terms of that data. So some data can mask overall improvements in other areas where we're not seeing that. And overall, we might be seeing that the trend is improving, either the gap is staying the same or indeed worsening in some cases. So we need to be nuanced about how we measure that. That requires capability, that requires systems, and that requires the right data to do that. So we're doing a lot of work to build the foundations for that, to be able to then answer the question, is what we're doing making a difference? Which I guess then comes to the point of over what time period. We can look at some of these activity measures about people coming and not coming, but really we're not going to know for a while about whether that's actually making a difference to their health longer term. So we're working to try and evaluate how we're going to do that over the longer term. So for example, the smoking cessation, we can count how many patients, what background they were, whether they were referred or not, but actually a sustained quit in the population groups that we really want to see is going to be a longer term endeavour. So it's a mixed answer in that we're trying to build the foundations to understand that, and we've got to spend the time thinking about what we can see immediately as well as further down the line.
So I think what you've said is that there are no kind of quick short-term fixes. This is a long, you're in it for the long haul, really, aren't you, as a trust, to kind of see like the benefit over kind of someone's like life course, really. And the second point I wanted to ask you about is that you mentioned some work you're doing with local with one of your local authorities. And it's really interesting, isn't it? Because the NHS obviously has a big part to play in tackling health inequalities, but the NHS can't do it alone. And you really need buy-in from partners across kind of the health and social care, from education, from housing. And so how did you go about building that relationship with your local authority to try and get that kind of kick-started?
Two things. One was learning from others. So we're not the first hospital, set of communities, local authority, local government that are doing this or want to work more together on this. We actually took some learning from international examples. There's a great example of Rush in Chicago that has a similar sort of transport network to London. They've got the L train, and they have this map that shows as you move out of Chicago that life expectancy gaps widen. And we have a similar thing in where I work in London, based on a tube map. So this gradient was very similar to us around this gap in life expectancy. what they did was realise within their organisation there's only so much they can do from a healthcare lens, and said we need to partner differently with both the community and the organisations that work and serve health in a broader sense. And they created a big collaborative called Westside United and had some brilliant success taking health equity as a system strategy. So one of the things I like to do is go around harvesting good ideas, steal shamelessly, share seamlessly. And so took this back to some of the leaders, both within my organisation and some of the communities we'd started building contacts within community organisations to say, look, this has happened in another place, in another part of the world, but they're trying to do something that we're really grappling with too. So how might we learn from that? And the second thing was looking at the commonality we have. So these are not our patients. These are people that live in the community. They are served by both our hospitals and the council that sits down the road. Many of the staff are people that have worked in both or one of the organisations, or family members do. The service users across both of those places. So there is some commonality there, first of all, that we share. So when we look at the gap in life expectancy between the north and the south of the borough, that's, you know, that's a shared set of concerns that we have as organisations. We then recognise our roles as anchors in that community and the ability to do something different through our lenses of being an employer, who we choose to purchase goods, etc. with. And it was an easy win to talk to community leaders in our local government organisation to say, actually, you want to do this stuff about reducing these gaps in life expectancy and making people healthier. And we definitely do. We want to reduce inequalities. So let's try and do something together and do something different. And next, well, it started off as sort of 10 to 12 years, but the next few years to see how can we work together in a different way that's probably less traditional for hospital organisations. And as you said, Susan, health and the determinants of health sit outside of a hospital. So how can we link up with those public health teams, the local government and the wider organisations to do that and play our part really well, and not assume that, you know, it's all within our gift or not at all within our gift, somewhere very much in between.
Thanks. Christine, so Dominique's obviously raised some interesting points about how Imperial is going about tackling health inequalities. How would you advise and encourage other boards to kind of do their buy-in, like to get them on board as well? Because it's obviously something that needs to be rolled out much further. So what tips and advice have you got?
Yeah, so it's really great listening to Dominique's experience of doing this work. And there's a few bits that kind of jumped out at me from that. One of them is to start with some of those really high level performance indicators that all trusts will be looking at. So all trusts will be looking at what are their waiting times like, what are their do not attend rates like, but really critically breaking that down by ethnicity and deprivation. And that will show a different story. And that's just a really important step in understanding what action do we need to take. Because most trusts will already have dealt with a lot of the low hanging fruit, as it were, around some of these things. So really understanding what that looks like and then thinking about what specific actions do we need to do to try and reduce some of our inequalities in those things. So being curious and actually looking at the data. The other bit to pick out was the idea of things that are in our control. And that really resonates with me, because I think this is potentially such a huge agenda. And much of it, if we're honest about it, is not in the control of the NHS. So understanding what are the bits that are and focusing on those as a starting point. And then kind of working out from that, there are things that we can influence in our role as an anchor institution as well that we can do. But there are plenty of things that are in our own control. And then linked to that is working in partnership. Most trusts will not have public health specialists embedded within them. And that is a barrier. But how can trusts work with their systems to get some of that expertise and some of that support around this? And finally, having a strategic approach. So making sure that this is embedded and that there is also governance to support this work in the organisation. And that's one of the things that we hope that this guide will help trust to do by building that into objectives for board members.
Some really interesting comments there. Thanks, Christine. And then Dominique, coming back to you, how would you see this guide being used within your board and like in terms of like governance and leadership at your trust?
Yeah, it's a really good point because I think the guide has got some fantastic areas around leadership, strategy, capability, analytics, which are all the things that I hope I've kind of highlighted and mentioned. I guess one of the things we've been thinking about as an organisation is making sure we have priorities that are sort of projects and programmes, they feel specific and people can get them done and start on them, versus how do you make this how the organisation operates and thinks about things. And those two things are often in a bit of tension. I guess there's an analogy to improvement projects and having a culture of improvement. It's a sort of similar mindset. So we've been trying to think about how do we make equity everyone's business? And should that be a separate meeting, set of reports that go up to give the benefit of that being, you know, specific vision, specific oversight and the ability to see all of the work in one place that's going on. But I guess some of the risk of that is that if you do that, that may end up becoming a sideline activity for the organisation where people think, well, I do my equity thing or my inequalities work here, but here's where I do my sort of other or, you know, more substantive work. So we've got an executive lead for equity and I report directly into them in my role as a director of population health. And I've been supporting work around how we think about that. And one of the ways that we're starting to try and sort of unpick is using equity as a domain of quality. So all hospitals will already have a reporting and governance set of structures and mechanisms for quality that goes up through various groups, committees, boards and data that flows with it. How can we ensure that equity is a key lens and a part of that? That said, then there's a whole like lot of people in the organisation who are really interested in talking about it, learning from it, doing things. So alongside that kind of more formal governance route, we're creating a forum, I guess is a good word for it, that's going to be more of a learning piece where people can kind of come together. But I think that has followed on from the work we've done about having a strategy, making our equity everyone's business and our framework around that, having, you know, significant board kind of leadership on it and trying to draw out measurement and analytics capability. And we're really lucky and fortunate to have in the trust a particular person that sits in our business intelligence team now who has a focus on health inequalities, and then the organisation investing in a role like mine, which is diverse and has a lot of things in the portfolio. I'm a public health consultant operating in a director of population health role. But inequalities and health equity squarely sits in what I do. And so coming back to that, it's both about the what, making sure you actually demonstrate change and have things to focus on that can make a difference, but also trying to embed this into the ways of working. And so coming back to the report, you know, those key pillars around the board leadership, around the governance, around analytics, around, you know, expertise and capability, particularly public health, that really aligns and chimes with a lot of the way in which I've been trying to support our organisation do that. So it feels really exciting and timely to come out on a wave of a bunch of other kind of policy stuff around having indicators and you know, the core 20 plus 5 and other bits of framework. So this feels like a really set of practical but important organisational things to do to get this work really embedded.
And so my final question to you, Dominique, and to Christine, Rachel was just saying that there are some trusts who just don't know where to start. If you had one piece of advice or inspiration or kind of guidance for those trusts, what would it be?
I guess I'm borrowing a bit from my other worlds of quality improvement, but I think it's to start somewhere and think big, but start small, because it can feel like you're boiling the ocean. With the amount that's possible you could do and all of the barriers in place for not having the funding for a health equity program manager, etc. I mean, we've been really lucky to have made the case for that after spending some time as the organisation trying to really understand what are the issues and where we want to focus on. But I think it's picking something and starting, and you'll soon realise once you do that lots of people find this really important to them. Many staff show up at work and work in a system like the NHS, which is free at the point of use to try and help ensure that everyone can benefit. And so when we see that they can't, it becomes a real like moral imperative for lots of staff. So you'll find lots of people working on things that you don't realise. And then once you start to bring them together, help them learn and share and bring a bit of strategic intention behind it, it can really start to kickstart the work. But I think there is definitely a leadership imperative on this, and that does come from the top. But I would say the first thing to do is just start somewhere, start doing something.
So think big and start small. I like that. Christine, your advice?
Yeah, I like that as well. And I think that it will not be a difficult thing to persuade people in organisations that fairness is important. People will get that. That will resonate with people. I would say the start small bit is pick some kind of measure that's important in your organisation and look at that measure by ethnicity and by deprivation. Because the thing that may be eye-opening to people is that the way that we are delivering this particular service in our trust is not fair. And that's an important eye-opener. People will understand that it should be fair, but they may not have that visibility that there will be inequalities. Because if you haven't looked for it, you won't necessarily know it's there. And I think that's a really good starting point of just picking something that your organisation looks at and look at it through a health inequalities lens.
Thank you to Rachel, Christine and Dominique for joining us today. A reminder that you can join in the conversation and subscribe to the podcast by following us on X, formerly known as Twitter, and LinkedIn at NHS Providers with the hashtag The Provider Podcast. Thank you.